It bothered Nimble Dick as well. Late that day, as dusk was coming on, he tried to see. A bear there was, a bear all black and brown and covered with hair, he sang, his voice as scratchy as a pair of woolen breeches. The pines drank his song as they drank the wind and rain. After a little while, he stopped. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Chimps and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to keep the same in the second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to GRRM for his amazing novels, FFG for this fantastic game, Card Game DB for getting us a start, and you, our loyal listeners, for sticking through thick and thin. Check us out on our website, Facebook, or Twitter, or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com and rate us on iTunes. This CC licensed music is Town Function by Spinners.
Bad here, Podrick said. This is a bad place.
There we go. What a quote this week, you know?
I'm moved.
It's pretty lame. It's pretty lame, but it just cracked me up too hard seeing Pod's response to the guy singing, just, this is a bad place. So, we went with it, okay?
I thought it was beautiful.
Thank you.
I can just envision Pod saying, just kind of having that nails on a chalkboard look, and it's like, oh, this is a bad place. What do I do?
Yeah. I can see that too. Well, fair listeners, hopefully this episode does not sound like fingernails on the chalkboard. Continuing to watch out for audio drift, so fingers crossed it's all good. But welcome to episode 310 of the White Book. I'm Will, occasionally still known as Kenan, and with me this week I have erstwhile co-host Kyle, and a second appearance from local player Arch.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, I may just call Podrick for the rest of the episode.
On a super unrelated note, I will say I think Pod is the one character in the show that I like, I don't say more than in the books, but makes me want more of them in the books.
Yes.
I
would agree with that. The amount of humor and just comic relief that Podrick, Jaime and Bronn have, and Tyrion, it's hilarious. Oh my goodness,
it's good.
I especially love the scene where he comes back to Tyrion and Bronn and tosses them the gold back after they told him to go have a great time down at the down on the Littlefinger's establishments, and they're like, mm-hmm. You were supposed to pay them. And he's like, no. They said keep it.
I mean, it was a cheap laugh, but it was so good.
Oh, yeah. Bronn's reaction was priceless. Like, how did he just... Ah!
Oh, man. You know, there is one other character that the show is making me want to see more of in the books, though, and that is definitely our giant wildling friend. You know, if now my brain is shut down. Quick, someone help me.
Dormund, Giant's Bane.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, if we ever get to see Tormund
meet Brienne in the novels. It's going to be great.
But you know what Tormund is really good at? A spokesman for hotels. I mean, I'm now blanking, unfortunately, on the hotel branch that he's on. But I walked into one of them. I want to say it's like a Super 8 or something. I don't know. I could be totally wrong. But I walked into one. I saw this giant cutout of Tormund Giantsbane. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. I just have to take a picture of this. This is excellent. I wish I could take it with me.
Yeah, I remember you guys sending me that picture. It was pretty amazing.
Very entertaining guy.
Let's see. I feel like there was probably a good segue to have made, you know, right there. Something about entertaining and announcements and news. I can't really put my finger on it. But let's, you know what, listeners? How about we assume that I did transition us well, and we just move on from there. Sound good?
Yeah.
Woohoo!
Sounds good. We're rolling. Yeah.
All right, so we've got some news this week, some Thrones news and some other LCG news. So tell you what, let's start with the non-Thrones news first. Get that out of the way up front, and then it can be all Thrones from here on out, so we're not bouncing back and forth. So in a nutshell, we've had some pretty big news for L5R. And that is the word that starting in November, they are going to release their entire first cycle of that game, one pack per week. So six packs, 6 weeks to get through all six of them, which is pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah, I really... That's a cool announcement, because I know a lot of people have been talking about, and I've known from experience with the Netrunner LCG, that the card pool is super stale with just a core set only until that card pool gets flushed out. So this is actually kind of exciting, and I know there's critics for both sides of this, but... I know. It's pretty exciting, and I'm excited to see what happens with it and see if they can stick to that schedule of six packs in 6 weeks. That's a tall order from what we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I assume we've known for quite a while now. It's a fairly open secret that the whole cycle is done all at once for each of the LCGs, and that the shipping statuses and production updates and whatever on the product pages on the FFG website are completely made up. So we've known for quite a while that these are all sitting in a warehouse at the same time. So as long as, you know, FFG gets them to their distributor, now only Alliance all together, and then Alliance ships out, then I think it'll be good. I'm curious what they'll do if they're going to ship them all together to retailers, and then it's going to be on the retailers to hold them and not put them out for sale. Because I can't imagine too many game shops are going to want to order a bunch of these, you know, every week to keep getting those.
Or keeping all that inventory backstage or waiting on street dates, you know, like, I don't know. That seems like if that's the way they go, like putting your game store in a bind is the wrong call. Again, brick and mortars. I mean, internet stores don't care, but still.
Yeah. Well, so I'm kind of curious. I've been thinking about the implications of this particular release schedule. And one thing, you know, I personally think it's probably a good thing. Tentatively, I don't know. I may have done faster than normal, but not quite this fast if it'd been up to me. But I've been a part of Game of Thrones, you know, when we hit the reboot to second edition and we went from a large card pool down to a very small core only card pool. And it took a long time to grow back in second edition. And for people to get used to it, there were a ton of complaints about the small pool that I don't really remember hearing, at least people be as vocal with in the other LCGs, because I've bought in to at least the core set of all of the LCGs so far, so that I could dabble in them. And I don't really remember, I think because the game was so new. You know, all the games, Conquest and Invasion, Cthulhu, whatever it might be, that folks still felt there was a lot to experiment with. And then Thrones hit this hiccup where it dropped from a very large first edition pool down to a very small second edition, but was much more continuous of a player base, basically. But L5R now has not existed as a CCG with that larger card pool for, what is it, two and a half years? Something pretty long.
I'm not entirely sure. I had very limited exposure to L5R in its TCG form, so you got me on that one.
I think we're sitting at least two, if my memory serves me right, which, you know, I don't know where the break is, or if there is a break where it gets treated more like a brand new game and people are excited just with the core set versus having that kind of closed in feeling of a lot of cards going down to a small pool. But I feel like 2 years may have been long enough that they didn't need to do this. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not.
I don't know. On the one hand, I agree with Will. When we went down to just a core for Thrones, it was brutal. You just felt so pigeonholed, especially if you wanted to be competitive at all on what you wanted to do. But at the same time, I really kind of liked how each chapter pack was almost like its own mini culture shock, because, I mean, the meta swung rapidly with each pack just from the percentage of cards being introduced to the total pool. And that was kind of neat to be a part of.
Inertia.
Yes, and I almost think, not to nitpick here, but like one every month, one every 2 weeks would be better. I think probably we waited so long, it felt like, for those first couple cards with the core set. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It's one of those, you know, which way would you rather have it? And the problem is that then, like, the rush is going to be nice for that month and a half, but then, let's say a month after that, the meta settles out. How long do you wait for new cards? How long do you sit there going, this is what it is?
There's nothing.
Because in typical FFG, there is no, here's what comes after it, or the long-term game plan, or follow-through. There's just, here's this idea, we're going to put this fish in the boat, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, have we heard anything, any whisperings or anything of what they're planning on doing after this in terms of scheduling? Because once the first cycle is there, are we going to get, is there whisperings of a deluxe expansion? Maybe, I don't know, 3 to 4 months out? Because I feel like the next step after this culture shock, that could lead to a potentially, it could lead to a potentially stagnant pool for a while. Granted, having an entire cycle to play with right off the get-go, you know, that's, there's a lot to experiment with there, especially with all of the different clans. But I'm not sure how long that's going to sit there until afterwards. So, or until the next iteration of new cards comes in.
Yeah, that, I think you're right there, RJ. That worries me that we haven't heard something about the release after this. If there's just going to essentially be a 5-month gap until there's more L5R cards. I mean, if I was them, I'd drop a deluxe like 2 months after this wraps up and then go with a regular release schedule from there on out or something. But who knows? But I do know we've seen other LCGs have a, you know, 6-month card gap, and it just decimated their player base. I'm looking at you, the Star Wars LCG. I mean, it's the biggest like brand in geekdom, and a delay on cards that long still has all but killed that game. I'm still surprised it's actually being printed.
Yeah, so we'll see. We'll see. It's definitely interesting.
This reminds me of that Eddie Murphy meme where it's like, you can't whisper what isn't there. Like, they have no idea what the next plan is. So I think on some level you wait and see. You're like, hey, let's drop this. See if it fixes some of the problems we had with Thrones. And then we'll just see what new problems pop up. And figure it out from there.
Yeah, that definitely sounds about right. But yeah, I think it's an interesting decision to get to kickstart the game right off the bat. I think that's from what we've discussed, I think that's something worth exploring, and they definitely had the opportunity to do it here. So yeah, we'll just have to see what happens in the future. So exciting news.
Yeah. Well, and we got more news this week. This was kind of a surprise, and this is actual Thrones news. We got the exact world schedule, which is really nice, but there were some tidbits in there that I think were unexpected that have surprised people. The main thing being that during the elimination rounds, there's an additional notes here on their schedule that says, prior to each game, each player will be provided with his or her opponent's decklist for a short review. Decklist will not be available for reference during the game. Which is a huge change for Game of Thrones. Huge! Not sure I like it, but I'm not sure I hate it either. I mean, I can understand the reasons why it's there, to kind of eliminate some of the advantage that folks get when they are actively scouting or just talking to friends about other decks that they saw during the day. So I know what they were going for, at least.
I know that I can say, at least my initial reactions, I fall in the camp of I am not a fan of this. For an example, at just a regional that I went to earlier this year, I was lucky enough to make it into top 8. Now, I realize it's not top 16 or anything. It's just a regional. We didn't have a huge player turnout like you would expect from Gen Con or Origins or Worlds. So definitely smaller size. But I did end up playing somebody in top 8 who I had not seen in Swiss before. I had no idea of what his deck tech was, because I was playing against a Targaryen banner stag. Honestly, the first time I had seen that pairing, and I'm just thinking, well, what could he possibly have in there? And that surprise factor really kind of set the tone for the game, because I didn't know what he was doing. He knew pretty well what I was doing, because I was playing a standard Targaryen fealty deck at the time. And just if I sat down and got to look at my opponent's deck list, that removes a lot of the surprise factor, which for Game of Thrones, if you have a couple one of cards that are secret tech, you know, you want to play those fairly close to the chest, or even some of the plots in your plot deck. So I'm honestly not a fan of removing some of that surprise factor.
It sucks. It's absolute shit. And I don't think scouting was really that prevalent. I mean, like RJ's saying, like, there are people that I played, and I may have even played them in Swiss and then again in Top Cut. And I don't know how much of their deck I knew, especially with an agenda like Schemes out. Like, how many of those schemes are you going to hit in a given game, you know?
Right, or knowing what's there and what their options could be at that given time during the game. You know, at that point, that's huge.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, yeah, some of the big metas, like DC, you know, legendarily did this and try to collect as much info as possible and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, I mean, you still have to play cards. And I don't know. I also feel like, who made the comment? I was reading through one of the debates on this, and they talked about how, I think Alex said it, talked about how the plot, like, everyone's like, well, Magic does this, so it's fine. And I don't think that's true, because it's different when it's 60 cards you can randomly draw. I think there's something about the plot deck that is different and a conscious choice. And sometimes it's real easy. Like, this is their opening plot. This is, like, do they run Valor? Do they not? And there are games where I may have played two rounds against a guy, or like, I'll be playtesting here and we'll go three games before I use it, and they're like, I didn't even think you had it. And it's like, well, I just situation hasn't been right. And I don't know. I just don't know if this was needed. And maybe that's me being the, like, starry-eyed optimist here, but, like, scouting has never been a huge part of my game. I mean, if you hear things, you hear things, or you, like, ask questions, but I never felt like it was, all right, I'm going to go hunt out as much info as I can. I know all the things he's got and what he's going to do. And you know, like, I mean, this is so much, it feels like such carnal knowledge. It's like, not only do you know, hey, he's running this event, you know how many copies he has, you know what other events he has. I mean, the fact that you can now sit here and, I mean, if you're Rain Man and can count cards, like, there are no surprises ahead for all of Top 16. And, I mean, I don't know. I just think it takes away a key part of the game. Like, I think Greg brought up the counterpoint, which is there are times when you're prepping for tournaments and you'll play against a guy 50 times. I mean, running those decks, you know them inside and out, you help build it, tweak it, whatever. And it just becomes a different game. And maybe it does, but I don't know if I like that game as much.
Well, I mean, speaking of the game and these games, I think part of what feels weird about it to me is that FFG keeps building these games, these LCGs, these card games, that rely for some aspect of their gameplay on hidden knowledge as a tool, that bake into the very rules an ability to try to bluff, to outwit, to outthink your opponent. You see that in the plots in Game of Thrones, where folks are trying to play into or around a Valor or March to the Wall or Naval Superiority or whatever. You see that in Netrunner with traps and agendas on the corporate side, where, you know, maybe this card that you're trying to access and steal is going to win you the game, Or maybe it's going to destroy your entire hand and wreck you. And, you know, there's the attempt to bluff there. Even in L5R, there's the new provinces, which I think get a little bit of that same realm. Maybe not quite as forceful as they can in Netrunner. But, like, now Nate was not lead on all of these games. But I know he has said in the past, when talking about analogies with Thrones and different skill sets, say, between Joust and Melee, comparing things to, you know, chess or poker. And this kind of poker bluffing element, I feel, is baked into a lot of FFG's games. And when you have this open knowledge beforehand, I feel like you're shifting that needle more towards chess than the strict game rules seem to be built for.
I agree with that. I think you lose. And as someone who enjoy, like, that's a big part of my game is setting up traps, is coming up with a script and trying to bait your opponent into it. And it's tough to do that when they know your event package. I mean, just when they straight up know it. Or it's like, oh, look, they're not running March, so sweet, I can just make what normally would be a sloppy play. I mean, if they scout, they're like, hey, I haven't seen him play it today, but I don't know. I mean, I think there's still enough of a percentage chance there that even if two of your buddies played him in a tournament, or you watched him on a final on a featured table video, just because you didn't see March, unless you see all seven plots, I don't think happens very often, I don't know that I'm just going to lay out a Tywin and risk losing my tournament on it. But when you hand me a sheet of paper that shows, hey, you can make this play and I can't stop you, I don't like that moment. I don't like that there's ever a moment that's created where, because of something that happened outside of the game, you can confidently walk into risky decisions with impunity.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You both hit my frustrations and what I was going to bring up on the head. My biggest thing was I came to Game of Thrones from Android Netrunner, where information is key, and I don't know. I think that I have seen whisperings of this exact same setup for Android Netrunner, and to me, taking away that hidden information aspect of the game is really disconcerting. So, in competitive play, so I think it's already been said enough. I'm honestly not a fan of this. So, that's all that I'm going to say on that.
I mean, in typical the fashion with this community, I think one of our members has already come up with maybe a more elegant solution to this. So Magic, from what I understand, adopted this rule because people were, top level players were very hesitant / resistant to going on featured table live streams, because it means future opponents might be able to scout out even the tiniest bit of information, and that was a disadvantage. And 1% is still greater than zero, and they would refuse to do it. Which, in that environment, with the stakes being what they are, like, I understand their stance. But we have someone in our community, I think it's, is it Rob's Gaming Table? Someone help me with the name on that? I think it's Rob.
Rob's
Gaming
Table?
Who at Gen Con recorded, I think so, recorded several games at, like, the top end of the Swiss group, and then recorded several Top Cut games, and he recorded them, and I believe, like, watched the stream somewhere else, like, nearby, and recorded his own commentary, and then once the tournament's over, uploads it. I mean, and he still gets tons of views. I don't think that many people would be hesitant to turning in a day late to watch some of these big games, and then you can filter out the ones that are duds, as opposed to watching it live. I don't think I don't know, maybe there is a huge draw for watching it as it happens, but I think we could have come up with ways to still bring that entertainment to people who are missing the event without it costing the players an aspect of their game.
I think my parting thought, so to speak, on this is that I want to clarify, I find it weird that I feel it kind of plays counterpoint to part of the rules of regular play of these games, but I don't feel, you know, particularly worked up about this particular modification. There's, you know, aspects I maybe disagree with or something, but I also see what those arguments are on the other side to have done this. Which makes me feel that if there'd been an article that explained this kind of change, which, let's be honest, it's a pretty big change for Game of Thrones, and, you know, any of these games, really, that if there'd been an accompanying article saying, hey, we're going to start doing this going forward, we feel that it's going to improve, you know, the level of competitive play, it's going to help keep events above board, you know, here's the reasons, you know, we acknowledge that there's X downside, but personally, as a company, I should say, we see that there's upsides, you know, A, B, and C that outweigh that. Like, I could have been very easily convinced, right? Like, I don't know if that's everyone out there. It probably isn't, but I always feel like more communication is a good thing, and that most players, if there is an explanation that kind of addresses a change and says, hey, this is why we're doing it, that they're much more likely to go along with it. So I think the main thing to me is that I'm just kind of disappointed that this was tucked away in the schedule and that there wasn't an article elaborating on it that went up at the same time.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Just the shock of, oh, here's this little, well, it's, I can't really call it an Easter egg, but this little bit of news. Surprise, here you go. No explanation. So that definitely rubbed, I would agree with you. That's definitely what has rubbed people the wrong way. And I know that I would, for the most part, be placated if I had some sort of explanation for it. So yeah, I definitely agree with you on that point.
Okay, well, we've hit the major news so far at this point. Who knows, by the time we're done recording this, something else may have dropped. I feel like it's been a very, very busy time for FFG lately, so we may have more to talk about next week. But for now, we're going to go ahead and swap over to our final main segment on this episode. And that is a Deck Doctor segment. So this is something we've talked about before. I feel like we've maybe done once on the show in the past. But we thought it might be an interesting way to kind of lead up to Worlds at the moment. So basically what it is, I've got a Tyrell deck that I've tinkered with just a little bit. You know, I threw something together after that last pack came out. And thought and played a few games and thought, okay, it almost feels like there's something here. I kind of like this engine. So here's the deck I've got. RJ and Kyle are going to help me kind of massage this, poke, prod, and examine, see if we can tweak and improve it. Then I'm going to play it this weekend. We've got a small local kind of prep tourney coming up. So I'm going to kind of take some notes on how it does and what happens. And then next week, we're going to examine that and kind of segue that into our Worlds discussion, preparing what how to prepare, what to prepare for, and that type of thing. So, sound like a plan?
Woohoo!
Sounds good to me. Let's do this.
Sweet. Okay, so I went ahead and sent the link here to both Kyle and RJ. So they should be able to get that called up on ThronesDB. I'll publish the list and let you guys have the link to it as well once this episode goes up. So currently the deck is titled All the Songs. You can probably guess a little bit of the content from right there. It's a bit of hyperbole. It's not truly all the songs, but it was very much inspired by the addition of Highgarden Minstrel to the meta. So I'm going to zip through the deck list itself real quick. I know that may not be super productive for listeners, but in case they're driving and can't look at the list, I don't want you guys completely without basis of what's going on. So it's Tyrell, Reigns of Castamere. We'll start with plots. Plot base is going to be Close Call, Confiscation, Filthy Accusations, Littlefinger's Meddling, Power Behind the Throne, Pulling Strings, Rebuilding, The Annals of Castle Black, The First Snow of Winter, Time of Plenty, Valor Margolis, and Wildfire Assault. Character base comes in at 32, 1 Alleri Tyrell, 1 Brienne of Tarth, 3 Garden Caretaker, 3 Highgarden Minstrel, 3 Knight of the Reach, 2 Lady in Waiting, 1 Littlefinger, 3 Marjorie Tyrell. This is the 6-cost Marjorie that searches for kings and lords. Then 3 Old Town Informers, 3 Olenna's Informant, 1 Paxter Redwin, 1 Randall Tarly, 3 Renly Baratheon. This is the good one, the 7-cost. 1 Garland Tyrell, 1 Hobber Redwin, 1 Knight of Flowers, 1 Varys. 14 locations, 2 Great Halls, 1 Horn Hill, 3 Pleasure Barge, 1 Renly's Pavilion, 3 Arbor, then 2 each, King's Road and Rose Road, and 16 events. 2 Rows of Gold, 3 Lord Renly's Ride, 3 Baron the Maiden Fair, 3 Dornishman's Wife, 3 Nightmares, and 2 Tears of Lys. So there we go. That's the deck. No attachments in it currently. All right. So initially, knowing the general game plan is to try and churn through a lot of song events, kind of craft my hand and keep getting gold to keep plowing through it, along with, you know, a little bit of flexible control from the Reigns of Castamere. That's kind of what I'm looking at right now. But I admit, I don't feel super strong about Reigns itself. Of course, there's a couple plots here that I think work nicely with this event-heavy scheme. But I don't know. Maybe I haven't gone in hard enough on intrigue. Maybe this is not the right agenda for it. But nothing else really quite jumped out at me. Any initial thoughts from you guys? Is this deck too unfocused, too scattershot?
I think Reigns is definitely doable out of Tyrell. I think the pumps are more useful than you think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, to win by 5.
So
I like how... go ahead.
So in situations like this, I usually make a mental note of, like, the 10 cards that are the core of what I'm trying to do. First off, I think of that, like, what is the goal of the deck? And I think, Will, you outlined that fairly well, what you're going for. Maybe distill that down a little bit. But you at least have a general idea. You want to try and utilize songs and the flexibility, and I get that. So I do that, and then I think of the, like, 5 to 10 cards I am most sketchy about. And I make a mental note of, like, what my last 10 in are. And I try to think about, when they come up, how useful they are in that moment and how what could have been better. Especially something like this, where, like you said, you're worried about things being too broad or too unfocused. So obviously there's some things in here you're probably raising an eyebrow to, like Littlefinger's meddling. Is, do you really find yourself in situations where you're being able to intrigue into that and then pound through a bunch of events? Could work great. Like, I can totally visualize you having a hand of like three events that cost gold and you're totally out when the intrigue, play a bunch of events, like it's all there.
Right.
Maybe Dornishman's wife, maybe the deck's a little more aggressive or quicker than you think it is, so you don't find yourself in a lot of situations where you can do this, especially with the cards in hand, because of all your card stuff. You know, that could be an issue. So you may find, like, I just try to think of those moments so that when it comes time to change out cards, or if you're, you know, so you go to this tournament, after a couple rounds, you're talking about it, and someone's like, oh, why don't you run XYZ? And you're like, oh, that's brilliant. You don't go cut the Highgarden Minstrels and Marjories of your deck. I mean, obviously those are extreme examples, but make sure what you're getting rid of are the things that you want to be getting rid of, and have that list done ahead of time, not on the fly where you're being emotional about how cards have performed in the moment. Because there's going to be some stuff that, you know, like, whether you like it or not, it's core to your deck, like that Minstrel. Like, you may have some games where, like, oh, this card was useless. I don't know what those situations are. I mean, it's a pretty easy reaction to trigger. But let's just say you're playing Burn or something, and he just keeps getting wiped off the board. You may have this, like, knee-jerk reaction that he's not worth it. And it's like, no. Like, he is core to the idea you're trying to flesh out. He has to stay. And you look at those fringe characters, those support roles, things that are filling out your character count. And that seems to be where those changes and that churn needs to be happening. Because I've seen too many players sit down and scrap core ideas to, quote-unquote, improve the deck. And it's like, well, now you've built a different deck. And you're never going to know if your idea was good because you've lost the forest for the trees.
That's a very interesting way of analyzing that. I never really thought of it that way. I kind of come, whenever I am asked to critique a list, I usually, I typically start kind of from the top down of, okay, what is the end goal of the deck and what are your win conditions? Because ultimately you could have a mechanic that, that works really well, but it's either the card pool isn't there, or there's not enough oomph, or it doesn't have enough effect to get you there. So I definitely see the point of the deck is utilizing the songs, and I think the one that is going to be the most impactful would be that Lord Renly's Ride to help you force through challenges, control the board with that intimidate, and really just start putting the screws to your opponent. Overall, I definitely see this as a very mid-rangey-ish deck, wanting to take advantage of that first snow and leave your big characters behind, or left standing on the field to go to town. So in combination with all of those, especially the Lord Renly's Ride and other strength buffs like Renly's Pavilion, I would personally like to see an additional Randall Tarley, because I think I see why there's only a one of, because you've got Marjorie, but having that extra one so that you could draw it naturally and then play him would be useful, but I definitely see Randall as being one of the powerhouses that can definitely drive this home.
I think Valor is an interesting choice. And I think that card is a discussion anytime you deck build in and of itself, you know, to Valor or not to Valor. Because I think especially with Tyrell, your thought being your characters are going to be better than their characters. And yes, you want things to die to fuel Margaery, but at the same time, you don't have, other than ladies in waiting, you have no form of saves on the board. Mm-hmm.
You're relying solely on duplicates.
And so I worry that you are going to get caught in situations where you cannot leverage that in any way that you want. And I think having a wildfire in your back pocket at all times, and then a even tougher pinch of Varus, might be enough. I don't know if this is a deck that wants Valor. So maybe that's a note for, like I talked about, like last 10 in, maybe that's a plot that you keep an eye on when you report back at the end of this tournament and say, did this help me? Did I win the games where I played it? Was it just a desperation move that wasn't going to save the game regardless? I mean, you should be thinking about how your games go regardless, but sometimes it's hard to focus on the big picture, and that's going to give you something small and specific to think about that's still highly constructive.
You know, Valor is, I admit, one of those cards that I've been kind of on the fence on in this deck, mainly for that save capability, though I have a good bit of draw and income, which offsets that to some extent. But at the moment, what had talked me into it was the Lord Renly's Ride in conjunction with Margaery there, since I have a couple different mechanics that want some of the, well, let's be honest, bigger characters to go ahead and die for one reason or another. That was what led me there. This isn't to say that I'm super attached to it. If you guys wind up counseling that it should come out and something else go in its place, but just acknowledging that was an extra consideration I'd had that had not been brought up yet.
And that makes sense. Like, I mean, and you've obviously thought out, like, I'm looking through this list and I try to think, I'm like, why is this in here? And, you know, there's valid points that comes back. But some cards are stuff that makes you, like, raise some red flags with it. And those are some of the things that I think about when, you know, like I said, talking about, well, what do you want to change? And you have to find, you can't just find things that, like, there's two sides to that. Like I said, they're not just things that you want to put in. There has to be things that come out to make room
right.
for that. So there's solid arguments here. I just think it's a card, and there's some others in here too, that you just keep in the back of your mind when you're playing and go, is this working out for me? Is this something I'm effectively able to leverage? Those are the first things I would go to if things, like, if you feel like you need to make changes at the end of this.
Okay. Well, that, I think, you know, leads to what I was about to say. Would you agree then with RJ's assessment that going kind of a mid-range, you know, possibly tempo control realm is probably the best idea to sculpt this deck into?
Yeah, I think you're going to putz around. Like, when I see this playing, I think you just kind of putz around, not putz around, but you play patty cake a little bit and, you know, get your shots in and you take some, but come round four, they have to go, shit, Will's sitting at 11, 12 power and you close this out. And they're sitting at 7, 8. I think it's just a little faster and a little smoother than most mid-tempo rides. And I think that's your game, is just to play that tempo and just make sure you're always like 2-3 power ahead of them and let that play out, which is eventually you at 15, them at 12. I think it's going to be a lot of close games.
So what else then is kind of on that short list of stuff that's in that bottom 10? You mentioned you saw some others that gave you some pause. So I'm kind of curious what you're thinking, and then maybe if there's anything that's just jumping out at RJ down in that realm as well.
Dornishman's Wife, I think, is one of the big ones. Just with it being Tyrell, I worry. And like I said, but let's say, so you've got 2-3 reset cards plus whatever they have. So I don't know how often you're going to be able to trigger these things. That one gave me pause. Talking about the one Randall. But again, you have no strength bumps. You don't have a ton of strength bumps for him. So it's not like you're running the attachment and trying to turn him into a Voltron. Like, that's not on your list. So I can get behind one.
I think there's a decent amount in there between the three Lord Renly's rides, Renly's Pavilion, and this sleeper card, Horn Hill. This just recently came out, and I definitely think this card commands a lot of respect, especially with, you know, with Randall, considering it's his home. But it also just gives him that extra strength boost to push him over the top. Like getting him in there once with and using Lord Renly's ride for that control factor with the Intimidate, because Intimidate is one of my favorite keywords. And I think in a deck like this, and especially in House Tyrell where strength matters, I think that's that could personally, that would be a little bit more of what my central game plan would be. But at the same time, kind of taking a step back, if you're going the more mid-rangey control route, I do like the heavy intrigue focus. Looking at the charts down here, you have 20 intrigue icons, and then 18 power, and then 9 for military. So you're definitely trying to control their hand and get them to a point where you can leverage your reset and then have kick the pendulum and have it start going the other directions. Like, okay, we're now closing in on the finish line, like you said, getting to that 13 or 14 power and then driving it home.
That is probably another thing that's worth considering while we look at this, is that icon spread. To some extent, my relatively low military count is offset by running quite a few resets here. So if we tinker with the resets, then it's probably also worth taking a look at that military icon count. Now, of course, adding another Randall in there, bare minimum, does help with that. But another consideration as we tinker.
I mean, I'm not as concerned about the low military icon count, just because a lot of them are on bigger, beefier characters. So it's not like it's not like most decks where that military icon, some of those are on Chuds, who are very rarely going to win you the challenge. Yours tend to be on your higher strength guys, so it wasn't as huge of a red flag for me. I was going to ask about Renly's Pavilion. And
what about
what the thought is there on that location? I mean,
it's in my mind just a very strong card on its own. Yes, it combines well with Randall, and if we slip in another Randall, then it gets even better. But it also just swings a lot of challenges. It's not necessarily getting me up to triggering Reigns of Castamere by itself very often, but it is in a lot of games I've played so far, not specifically with this deck, but games in general, Renly's Pavilion's 2-point swing there has been enough to swing a challenge pretty consistently.
Okay. I would say, just sitting here talking, I think you have to look at upping. I think upping Randall's important, right? Because you want to go get him with Marge, and theoretically you can then go get a dupe. You can, you know, like, so Marge works, right? She fires off. You gotta go get somebody, and it's better to have guys worth getting. And if your Randall card gets popped for whatever, I don't know. I'd like to see a second copy of him.
I guess whilst we're talking about that, whenever I have a tutor card, a very special and specific tutor card like Marjorie, I always ask myself 9 times out of 10, what am I going to get first in a vacuum? And I guess
Renly.
Renly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. That would definitely make sense.
But Randall would probably be my second choice.
Yeah. Plan B is solid. What's the thought on Old Town Informer? Is it just when Marjorie fires, she lets you filter?
She doesn't just trigger off of Marjorie. She also triggers off of herself in Dream Play. She triggers off of Elena's informant in Dream Play with Ambush. Let's see. I feel like there was another trick of some kind in this deck. Am I missing it? No, maybe not another trick there, aside from First Snow potentially gives me extra triggers. But she does also trigger off of any opponent's stuff entering play. So, running up against an opponent playing Lannister with the Hound suddenly doesn't look so bad to me. But she churns through cards at a pretty prodigious rate. Which I really like. And I had played a different Tyrell deck after she came out. They'd only played two of her at first. Actually, the one I took up to Gen Con. And I just realized she's... I knew she was good, but she is so good. So.
All right. And then the informant. Like, are you look... I mean, obviously you look to ambush her, right?
Right. Now, the informant, I do admit to being a little more questionable on that. On the one hand, helps me work with my kind of skewed icon count by maybe being able to make an additional intrigue challenge and put some of those icons to use. But the main draw at the time was additional triggers for the Old Town Informer, as well as ways to utilize gold in the gold phase. If I'm sitting there with, two Bear and the Maiden Fair in my hand or something, and get a couple extra gold from the minstrel, then the question is, what can I do with that gold? So, not necessarily saying the informant is the best plan for all of that. And if she does stay, then it's probably worth, looking to make sure she's being maximized, especially with, say, that additional Randall that we just added in. So there's chances to get him into extra challenges, but that was the current reasoning for her.
Sure. She's just one that I would keep. Again, you try to pick five to 10 cards to watch out for. And I think she's one that, like you said, you look and you see, is this something where it's sitting in my hand? I always have better uses for that gold, or my gold curves in such a way, like, runs too tight where leading four gold behind for her is just not the play. Now, again, like, you can't, and I hate tweaking and making decisions pre-gameplay. Like, I honestly am a big proponent that you feel good and I've thought this out. There's nothing glaringly bad about it to me that you go play it, but just so that those games and that tweaking and rebuilding on the far other side of it, which I think is a key part of developing a deck, you don't come away going, yeah, I did well, or it went badly. You have to be able to answer why, or what went well, or what went badly. And I feel like it's too hard, like I said, to look at the whole big picture, but she's a card I would definitely keep my eye on each round, and maybe afterwards jot down notes about how these cards did.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And if you come to a situation where you question the informant, obviously her effect is to get that additional challenge. But you win the game by getting power. And there is also in Oberyn's Revenge, Olenna's Machinations, which lets you make that additional power challenge and lets you get it back into your hand if you win an intrigue challenge, which, again, seems like it fits very well into your strategy. It is also recurable. So I think that is a card.
Oh, so I was just going to say it could potentially work with the Old Town Informer. as a card I can pitch to her and get back.
Uh-huh, exactly. So I think that is a card that is definitely gives Tyrell a lot of teeth, especially with having a lot of very beefy and healthy power icon characters. And I think that might be a little bit easier on the gold curve and might still smooth out your deck mechanically, being able to discard a card for your filter effects, but also have use for it later. So that's just a thought.
I also raise an eyebrow at Varus, just because it doesn't... I'm trying to get situations where you're going to want a Varus. And I feel like if you still have Valor in hand and you can still scheme flip into a Wildfire, that if and first snow, if those things can't help you, I don't think Varus does, especially because he can't trigger Marge. He just seems a little out of place here. And I understand like the resets and the military icons, like, I get it. But I worry that there's never, since you have essentially 2.5 on-demand resets, that he is not something you need.
He's superfluous.
Yeah, I mean, he's a lord. Like, don't get me wrong, but isn't he? I assume he's a lord.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Because the thought was to potentially search him out with Marjorie in a pinch. Let someone else die to go get Varus. Now,
sure.
That doesn't mean he may still be too redundant for the deck, but that was the thought.
And he may be one that you keep an eye on when you draw him and you're like, and I don't say I hope you have tough games where you need to swing it back, but if you're in that situation and the better play is just to first snow or just to give the look that you're muscling on and then flip into Wildfire after he's like, oh, he's not going to reset, and your opponent loads up the board and then you Wildfire it away. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think there's potentially better avenues. Now you may get into the games and in the pits and Varus may be the right call. I just think there's other things there to think about.
Sure. I could definitely see that.
Though stealth is nice. I mean, it does power home, you know, the agenda, which I think is underrated but good here. So yeah, he's on my short list. I think that's it, though. I think those are the only things that, the only tires that I really find myself kicking. I really like the nightmares. I really like tears.
Yeah, in the couple games I did play so far, bar nightmares, I think, was really kind of the star in the songs really powered me through to have a nightmares anytime I needed it, between that and Annals of Castle Black, and just always having nightmares on demand is pretty awesome. I mean, now I'm not gonna lie, I lost the game in particular that I'm thinking of in the end anyway. But I had that Nightmares to deal with an Astapor that had 5 gold on it for, if I remember right, every turn of the game. So, you know, if I hadn't had that availability, it would have been really disgusting.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like the core concept with what we've discussed and what you've talked about, and I really like that with this deck. It's different. It's new. And it's a house that I personally haven't explored a lot. Tyrell is one of the last houses that I haven't just played a lot of, and a lot of their, I'm familiar with all of the cards, but I'm not really well versed on playing with certain interactions. So, I definitely like what I see here, and I would have to go along with pretty much all of our suggestions, that definitely play several games with it and keep an eye on that short list and just kind of see what happens. And I really like this, and I'm going to be excited to listen to the episode after this to hear what your experiences are.
Okay, so like certain changes that we've talked about, like for certain, not specific, but also specific because I'm going to recap them. We're going to go ahead and drop a Varys for another copy of Randall. That's a pretty easy swap out of what we've been talking about. There was also some talk about Dornishman's wife, which I agree to being a little on the fence for sure on how that's been going. But I'm also a little worried about letting my song kind of pool shrink too small. So, I'm not sure how many of those, if any, to drop. At least one, maybe. That would leave me with 10 song events. Does that seem reasonable if I'm trying to utilize Highgarden Minstrel to keep a chain going? Is it fine to go ahead and drop it down to 8 and cut the Dornishman's wife completely? Do I need to go up to 3 rows of gold if I do that? Any more concrete thoughts on that issue, guys?
I think 8 to 10 would be a sweet spot, especially given how much draw and filtering that the songs play into. So I think that would be fine. If you maybe wanted to sub a couple, one or two of those slots out for possibly Olenna's machinations, it's in the same gold cost slot and gives you that extra push and lets you utilize your gold that you earn off of the minstrel. So that would be a suggestion, but I think 8 to 10 would be a sweet spot.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, some of this stuff you're just not going to be able to flesh out till you put cards down and see how they do, and see how effective and workable things really are when it comes time. You know, you may get in there and go, you know, what we've always known, Renly's really good, and I wish I was leveraging him more. Or you may get into and say, hey, with the meta right now, they can control characters, and that's not the route I want to go. I mean, there's just some stuff you're going to have to feel out.
Okay. Well, I'm willing then to go ahead and give it a whirl, dropping those Dornishman's wife, and dropping in a couple Olenna's machinations and kind of seeing how things go. I do like that lets me lean harder on the informers to keep churning through cards. And, you know, since we also said we were kind of on the fence on it, and I'm gaining another way to make additional challenges and a way that does cost gold, so it's given me something else to spend challenge phase gold on, I think I'm going to drop down to just 2 of the Olenna's informant at the moment, which should bring me to exactly 60 cards. So,
sweet. I like it.
Okay, we'll see if those are the tweaks I need to dominate this Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'll be curious to hear what the listeners think, because I really expected my co-host to just tear that apart a lot more. You guys were way too nice. You were like worried about my feelings or something, and I brought this deck on specifically to have, you know, whatever things it was doing wrong ripped out. So
I think on some level you have to go flesh it out, because there's a lot of ideas that ended up being really strong that I didn't play. Like, I remember talking about builders or like back a bunch of concepts back in first ed and being like, wouldn't that be a deck? Yeah, it might be, but I doubt it's really strong. Or, you know, like RJ's question, like, what's its win condition? How does it win? And the answer was not apparent to me at first, so I moved on. And then next thing you know, it's winning a regional a month later. And it's like, oh boy, you know, if I had just like built that and played some games, I might have realized that, you know, this is stronger than maybe what looks like on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So I try really hard to support ideas until you see that they suck.
Good thinking.
Yeah, and I am of the opinion that this is a deck building game. You're going to build a deck that feels comfortable to you, and you need to be comfortable piloting it. As you guys have mentioned before on previous episodes, you could take the hottest deck on the market, sleeve it up, play it, but you're never going to play it as well as somebody who has all of the reps. And I think that translates over to the deck building standpoint. You're not going to get the full value out of that. So putting something together from the ground up, like we've done, flushing out those ideas, taking it to playtesting, running all those iterations, that gives you probably more experience than just sitting down with a standard deck and just running reps with it. So I'm definitely one for understanding and exploring those underlying concepts and those different archetypes and those different cards and just seeing what works and what doesn't. So that's that.
Cool. Props and slops. Who has been up to something good this week? I think my main prop is to high school reunions. I actually went to a fun one last weekend. Kristen's second high school reunion. Long story short, she graduated from a different school than she'd gone to the rest of her life. So both schools let her come. And this one was the first one I've been to since mine and the other one of hers that actually felt like a party and not just a, kind of a dinner event that the attendees felt obligated to go to. So I liked that.
Very cool. I too have a prop that I would like to give. Kind of props to Springfield Game. This past weekend, it was Springfield's Gaming Convention, Games Arts Media Exposition, for the full acronym. But I had a blast this past weekend. I went there with another podcast that I'm part of, and we had a wonderful time. And if it's all right with you guys, I would like to take this opportunity to give a shameless plug to that podcast.
Yeah, awesome. I was about to tell you to.
Yeah. The other podcast that I'm a part of is Mediocre Gamers, a podcast about all things gaming. So we had a great time this weekend and really just sat down and had a booth where we just played games with random people. And we're there for the experience, meeting new people. So it was awesome. And if anybody is interested in joining our community and kind of branching out, you can find us on Facebook at Two Mediocre Gamers. You can find us on Twitter at Two Mediocre Gamers as well, and mediocregamers.com. So that's that. Good stuff.
Kyle, you got anything this week?
I was thinking. I will prop Springfield Brewing for winning gold for best brown ale in America at the Great American Beer Festival this past week.
It's pretty rad.
Drinking That's in awesome. Springfield is a casual hobby of mine for being a town I don't live in. I don't think we've been there, so that'll be exciting to kind of check out.
Definitely. They've got a lot of really good food, too. I can vouch for that.
And I believe there's a place an hour west of here that took Best Quad. So I'm going to hopefully go get over a bottle or two of it to have around for you guys to try. And maybe we'll have you bring that one up and I'll bring mine and we'll drink in the middle.
Nice. I like it. That sounds good to me. All right. Well, is that another one you wanted to get in?
No, but I heard a cat. I love cats.
Exactly. It sounds like Luna may be demanding some attention from Kyle. So I think we should call it a wrap before he winds up in the danger zone. Yep, that definitely closes this chapter of the White Book.